Good morning, early birds. You've caught the worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio and our public media friends across the region, bringing you the latest news. I'm Carl Lengel, your host. Here it is, the 19th of February, a Thursday, 2026. There are signs the presence of fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opioid, may be declining in Montana. The drug was largely responsible for the increase of opioid overdose deaths during the pandemic. But Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports other dangerous drugs are emerging in the state.
According to the state health department, the number of drug samples testing positive for fentanyl was cut in half between 2024 and 2025. A decrease that large likely means there is less fentanyl on Montana's streets. But that didn't equate to fewer overdoses. Ambulance services responded to roughly 250 more suspected opioid overdoses in 2025. That's a 35% increase compared to the previous year. Overdose deaths also ticked up slightly. Tasha Cameron runs drug harm reduction programs for Butte Silver Bow County and hears directly from people using drugs. She says there are new drugs like xylazine and animal tranquilizer showing up.
We just see such a variation of additives that it's hard to pinpoint. I mean, that's how chaotic it is.
Cameron's staff regularly trains those using opioids to use the overdose reversal drug Narcan. She says people may use it on someone they thought took fentanyl, but they don't wake up.
Narcan doesn't work with the xylazine. There's really not much in the moment to do other than call 911.
That might explain why 911 calls for overdoses ticked up as the presence of fentanyl went down. Adam Sibley is with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill's Opioid Data Lab. It tests illicit drugs from all over the country.
I would say that we've moved from a crisis mostly driven by fentanyl to a crisis driven by adulterated fentanyl, and specifically with these sedatives like xylazine and metatomidine.
Sibley says less exposure to opioids could decrease overdose risk, but says the drug supply is more complex than it's ever been and remains dangerous. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A lack of snow in Bozeman has caused the collegiate skiing championships to change locations. The NCAA announced in a Tuesday news release that the 2026 National Collegiate Skiing Championships have relocated to Utah Olympic Park for the Alpine events and the Soldier Hollow Nordic Center for the Nordic events on March 11th through the 14th in Park City, Midway, Utah, with the University of Utah as the host school. The event was scheduled to be hosted by Montana State at Bridger Bowl Ski Area and the Crosscut Mountain Sports Center. The NCAA said the move was made due to the lack of snow in the Bozeman area, and the Division I Cabinet Subcommittee approved the new host site. Utah has already been selected to host 2028 National Collegiate Skiing Championships. They will host the Winter Olympics in 2034. A Democrat and former Wyoming lawmaker is running for U.S. Senate. James Byrd represented parts of Southwest Casper in the State House from 2009 to 2019. He said he's running to, quote, be Wyoming's representative to Washington, D.C., and not Washington's representative to Wyoming. His campaign announcement says he believes in education for everyone, public lands in public hands, and that health care is the bedrock of a strong and a thriving community. Byrd joins Republicans Jimmy Skovgaard of Mills and current U.S. Representative Harriet Hageman already in the race. Wyoming's primary election is August 18th. After a conservative activist hand-delivered a donor's checks to some conservative lawmakers on the Wyoming House floor last week, Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon issued an executive order prohibiting soliciting, delivering, or accepting campaign contributions on property where state business is conducted. He said he'll seek a permanent rule change. But the governor doesn't have authority in parts of the Capitol managed by the legislative or judicial branches, including the Senate and House chambers. Laramie County law enforcement launched a criminal investigation into the incident. The House and Senate are also both looking into what happened. The Senate has yet to establish a formal investigative committee. A House committee has paused the investigation while the county sheriff's inquiry plays out. As three Montana protesters arrested last fall reach a plea deal, they're sending a message about immigration enforcement. Laura Hatch with Big Sky Connection has more.
Border Patrol agents detained a mother and her 17-year-old daughter from Flathead Valley, Montana, last September after a traffic accident. Protesters gathered at the Whitefish Border Patrol station that night to try to stop the agency from sending the pair to an ICE detainment facility. Leonette Galaz, Flathead Democracy Director, stepped in front of a Border Patrol truck she believed was carrying the detained pair as it was leaving the facility. Whitefish police arrested Galaz and two other protesters the next morning. She says it was worth it.
For a mom and her daughter to be taken into custody and then transferred to an ICE detention facility was a big enough issue, an important enough issue for us to put our bodies in front of a car at great risk to ourselves, understanding that we would be arrested.
Galaz and two other protesters, Colton Little and Aggie Putnam, will plead guilty at today's hearing to obstructing a peace officer and public nuisance. They'll serve a 6-month deferred sentence and pay around $700 in fines. Lucia Torres and her daughter, Fergie Diaz, are originally from Honduras and were transferred to the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Texas. Galaz says they've been released and are awaiting action on their asylum case. I'm Laura Hatch, reporting.
MSU Billings credits enhancements in university resources and programs for a 13 percentage point increase in student retention since 2020. In a Monday press release, the university notes that for the first time in nearly two decades, retention of new freshmen and transfer students from fall to spring semester is higher than 82%. The university credits an applied effort on persistent and intentional student success, from academic advising to tutoring to scholarship support when students need it. The university has exercised a continual culture of care for students. Keeping students on track for first enrollment in the fall to the next semester is the first step to ensuring they graduate on time, according to the university. A review of those cohorts shows MSU Billings has hovered around 75% for about two decades. Spring retention this year, however, climbed a dramatic 5%. Two Montana companies have shown that hemp clothing can be made entirely in the United States again, although it does cost more. The Montana Free Press reports the effort starts with hemp grown north of Fort Benton and processed by IND Hemp. The partners spent years piecing together a manufacturing chain to make it happen without the material ever leaving the U.S. The shirt reached stores in December after a long multi-state production journey and a lost roll of fabric. The first run was 239 men's work shirts at a price of $150. The companies say the project proves a point, but the next batch of shirts will be sewn overseas. Hemp is often held up as a versatile crop with all sorts of applications, fabrics, home insulation, even edible seed oils, to name a few. But it was illegal to grow or distribute hemp in the U.S. for nearly a century until 2018, when Congress lifted federal restrictions on the marijuana-adjacent plant. So, when a Fort Benton hemp processor and a Great Falls-based apparel company sought to make a line of U.S.-made hemp shirts, they had to scrap together a supply chain to make it happen. Montana is one of a shrinking number of states that doesn't have a law regulating student cell phone use in school. Research increasingly suggests the devices play a role in rising rates of anxiety, depression, and distractedness in kids. Some schools are taking matters into their own hands and taking input from students along the way. Montana PBS reporter Hannah Kears joined Montana Public Radio's Austin Amestoy to discuss the trend.
Hannah, the debate over student cell phone use in schools is not new, but it is starting to heat up in Montana and beyond. So where did you go to get an idea about what those conversations look like in schools?
So I went to Bozeman Schools to talk about their phone policy, and I was interested in seeing what they were doing because they're in this in-between time where their current phone policy is going to end this semester, and next school year, it's going to be a more restrictive phone policy.
Tell me about that transition. What does it look like now, and what are they moving toward?
So right now, high schoolers in Bozeman can use their phones during non-instructive periods. That's like lunch and passing periods. But next year, the phone policy is going to include those times to restrict cell phone use for students.
Interesting. How has Bozeman gone about crafting this policy? Who are the stakeholders?
Bozeman really came to this phone policy looking at it from student mental health and well-being. That is the broader goal of it. Cell phone policies is one pillar of that goal. And they put together a work group of 16 people, including administrators, students, parents, teachers, community partners, to learn more about the links of cell phones and student mental health.
So students were part of that working group. That's really interesting. Did you get a chance to speak to any of them?
Yes, I spoke with Taylor Truden in her Ceramics 2 class. Taylor is a senior and the class president. She was also one of the members of that work group.
I think it's really important that we take away the phones, not only for the academic aspect. I think a lot of the district employees really focused on the academic aspect and kids not being distracted by their phones. But I think as students really focused on the social aspect of it, like even just in the hallways and talking, when kids are on their phone, they're not communicating and they're not connecting with each other.
And there is a growing body of research that backs up what Taylor is saying there. And I understand, Hannah, you spoke with University of Montana psychologist Rachel Severson. How does her research play into this story?
Her work focuses on the developmental stage of our brains, those teenage years, where she says research has shown clear benefits is in an academic setting. So taking the cell phones out of the classroom, there's clear benefits to reducing that distraction. Even having your phone on silent can be a cognitive drain. Where things got a little mixed bag of evidence was the impacts that restricting or reducing cell phone use has on students' mental health.
Some evidence suggesting that it is benefiting kids, you know, improving their mental well-being because they're not having that chatter that is then bleeding over into the face-to-face interactions, and that it's increasing well-being as a result. However, the kids themselves are reporting that they feel worse.
There are going to be administrators listening to this conversation, I'm sure, Hannah, who are going through a similar discussion right now in their school. So from your experience, what makes for the crafting of a successful cell phone policy in schools? What sort of things should they be doing?
I'm not an expert at what's going to work and what's going to fail. But some of the things that I've been talking with administrators and districts and psychologists about is including the students in the policy and making the policy goes a long way of figuring out how it's going to be successful.
Montana PBS reporter Hannah Kearse joining us today. Hannah, thank you for your reporting.
Well, thank you so much.
You can hear Hannah's full story on tonight's episode of Montana PBS Reports Impact at 7 p.m. on Montana PBS and online soon after at montanapbs.org.
Lincoln County was hit hard by flooding from winter storms, but it could have been worse. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Traxler reports years of preparation helped prevent further damage and kept residents safe.
Lincoln County's head of emergency management, Boyd White, parks his car on Granite Creek Road outside of Libby. Ahead of him is a gash in the roadway where a bridge once stood.
So Granite Creek enters into Cherry Creek just a little ways out of sight up here from us.
The jagged edge of asphalt marks where Big Cherry Creek swelled to forces capable of dislocating boulders. Boyd peers over the gap, looking down at the small creek below that caused such damage.
We went from a stream bed that was probably 200 feet across to probably 400 to 500 feet across.
The historic December floods physically changed the community. Though the intense weather tore up bridges, toppled trees, and flooded homes, no lives were lost. That's because Libby knows floods. Records of major floods in the area date back to 1933. A closer look at that history shows decades of mitigation measures, plans, and preparations that officials say prevented further catastrophe in December. The largest example of these efforts is the Flower Creek Dam. Located just south of Libby, the dam sits on Flower Creek, which flows into the Kootenai River. It was built in 1946 to hold the town's reservoir, retaining over 92 million gallons of water. It's a high-hazard dam, which means if it fails, people will die. County Commissioner Jim Hammonds remembers when that threat felt too close for comfort.
I think in 2013 and 14, they had realized with some of the core samples that that dam was in serious need of replacement.
Core samples are taken when engineers drill out a cylinder of material from the dam. Normally, they look like solid tubes of concrete.
The core samples that we took out were coming out in just chunks and literally broken up like gravel. So that's what was inside the dam.
Hammonds worked as the city administrator at the time. He says catching the dam's issues when they did relative to recent floods was a near miss.
Some of these major events that we've had with the water, rainstorms, I'm almost sure that it probably wouldn't have held up.
Dam construction began in 2015. Victor White was the emergency manager for Lincoln County, which is now his brother's role. He himself lives just downstream from the dam. His job was to prepare for the worst, a dam failure.
How do you plan for something to break that will be within just a few minutes covering the town?
He developed a text alert system. He formed evacuation plans for neighborhoods, businesses, and elementary schools. In a tight-knit community, White says the task felt heavy.
But all I could think about in that time, and we had that team working on, we had a future of kids out there. How do we take care of them?
A year and $15 million later, the dam was finished. Flash forward to this past December when 7 inches of rain fell in 24 hours. The floods damaged a diversion structure downstream, but the upper dam held. Back in City Hall, emergency manager Boyd White sits in his office surrounded by photos of the storm damage and maps of floodplains.
We came out of it pretty well, I think, but we've still got some work to do that could make things better for the future.
Looking forward, these events might be more common. Climate models for this region predict increased winter precipitation that falls as rain rather than snow.
Certainly, it seems like we are getting, like I said, warmer weather later into the winter on a pretty regular basis.
He believes preparation means planning, investing in infrastructure, and updating their floodplain maps. They also have a countywide hazard mitigation plan that is reviewed annually. For Boyd, this is what helped save lives during the recent floods in Lincoln County. But it also better positions them to receive state and federal financial support. Damages are currently estimated to cost over $10 million.
$10 million on the county, and we have to put that out in advance while we're waiting for all this, you know, red tape to work through. That's a burden, especially for a poor county like Lincoln County.
For now, their focus is on fixing the roads and bridges and preparing for a future when winter floods might be more common. Boyd works by his mantra.
And kind of plan for the worst and hope for the best type thing.
Reporting from Libby, I'm Victoria Traxler.
The James Beard Foundation Restaurant and Chef Awards announced at the end of January the semifinalists for Culinary Excellence. Chef Brandon Dredden made the list as a semifinalist for Best Chef Mountain for his restaurant Ember in Hamilton, Montana. Stella Fong, host of Flavors Under the Big Sky, talks to Chef Brandon.
In the heart of the Bitterroot Valley, Brandon Dredden is changing the culinary scene in the restaurant he owns with his wife, Christina. Ember, located in downtown Hamilton, is a wood-fired progressive American restaurant focusing on featuring local ingredients.
I wanted to do what Thomas Keller did to Napa Valley back in the early 90s.
And how is Chef Brandon accomplishing this here under the big sky?
You put a fork in the ground, you say, okay, like, I want to represent Bitterroot Valley, Montana. And it has been an uphill battle, but also, like, I think the James Beard nomination and just being recognized and a ton of eyeballs on Hamilton, Montana, not only drives business to downtown Hamilton, but it also tells people that, oh my God, there's a restaurant that's worth going to here in the sticks.
Chef Brandon understands and appreciates the bounty that is found here.
The Hamilton Farmers Market, like, blew me away. It's, if not equal or better than what you see at Santa Monica's Farmers Market, it's just more microclimate, right? So you don't get asparagus all year long. You don't get strawberries all year long.
Not only was Chef Brandon surprised that local restaurants were not serving anything from the farmers market, but he was also taken aback when eating at a local steakhouse.
And I'm just like, so you don't have any local beef? There's so much local beef, but you don't have any local beef on the menu. And I'm like, all right, it's fine. And I'm like, you know, I got to change that.
And how did Chef make that change?
I met with a local rancher, local farmers, and I've been trying to develop these relationships, and it doesn't happen overnight. It takes years.
All his hard work and diligence may be paying off.
This year is going to be Ember's year to finally, where the ranchers and farmers are prioritizing my requests first, right? Where the first year it was like, yeah, whatever. You know, I'm just going to sell what I have at the farmer's market, and I'm not even interested.
So how did Chef convince the producers to change their minds?
If you grow this lettuce for me, I'll purchase the whole crop. I've really been doing the best I can to try to develop these relationships with these ranchers and farmers.
So how is Chef Brandon Druden going to get the word out about the flavors being created in his town of 8,000 people?
There's only so many people you can feed and cater to in Hamilton, Montana. The internet is undefeated as far as reach.
Chef Brandon knew that social media was going to allow him to reach worlds beyond the heart of the Bitterroot Valley when Ember opened in 2022.
So basically, when we opened the restaurant, I put in the pro forma that I wanted a videographer, right? I was like, you know, it's really important that we document the process.
To accomplish documenting that process.
So I hired somebody that not only could cook, but could do prep work, but also was an entry-level videographer to follow me around with the camera, really focusing on creating polished content with recipes.
And those recipes show thousands of followers how to make chicken pot pie, sourdough bread, Ember carrots, pancetta wrap pheasant, and so much more. These videos have not only put light on Ember and Chef Brandon.
With eating at Ember, you're not just supporting me and the staff that comes here every day. You're also putting the money back right into the community. Lifeline Dairy, Western Montana Growers Co-op. This puts the money right back in the community instead of importing things from outside, which we have to sometimes.
But most times, Chef Brandon Druden endeavors to highlight the efforts of local producers. And one of the reasons why he is a semi-finalist from the James Beard Foundation for Best Chef Mountain.
For me, just to be nominated year one of like trying to make an effort, like it really is very humbling.
Many congratulations to Chef Brandon Druden for being a semi-finalist for Best Chef Mountain from the James Beard Foundation. This is Stella Fong for YPR News.
That's The Worm for this Thursday. Catch up with us tomorrow. We'll have another episode for you early birds then.
The Worm is a production of Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal art call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.